let's get started today. So thank you again for everyone filling out the quiz. In the end, everyone made it, so that's great. We can discuss, actually, like, this time everybody did really, really well, but there were a couple of things that I want to clarify, but I'll just do that in the tutorial so we don't eat into more lecture time. But just one thing, one comment that someone said is that they were would like a little bit more clarification about the difference between pure states and mixed states. So I just want to kind of sketch out something. So possibly the thing that's leading to confusion is that I'm using some things interchangeably, that I mean them to be the same, but it might not be obvious that they're the same thing. So let me try and draw this grid and see if it helps. So at the beginning of the course, I introduced these pure states in postulate one, and I said that they can be described by this state vector. And then I could use an equivalent description with a density matrix that is just given by the outer product of the state vector. And so these two things are equivalent, and they both describe pure states. Then later on, I introduced this notion of mixed states. And those were given by a density operator that had the following decomposition. And the condition for it to be mixed, which I define as not pure, is, oh, okay, so first there's a condition on these things because you want the probabilities to sum to one. But the condition that makes it not pure is that none of the PIs are equal to one. Because if one of them was equal to one, that would mean that the rest of them have to be zero, because of this condition, and that would mean that we only have one sum in this term, and if we had one sum, then that would give us this state, which is a pure state. And because we necessarily have to describe mixed states like this, there is no equivalent description in the state vector picture. So you might think, well, let's just get rid of this state vector picture because it's just kind of confusing having these two different ways of thinking about it. And we can just do everything in terms of density operators. And, you know, either they have one term and they're pure, or they have more than one term and then they're necessarily mixed. And so that's kind of what we're doing. It's just that I'm lazy and, I mean, well, not, I think most of us want to try and save time. So whenever I'm dealing with pure states, it's just easier to do all my calculations with this state vector, and it's kind of implied that what I mean by that is I can always turn that into a density matrix. So what I'm saying is that I often just use these interchangeably. Okay, so just some notes. For pure states, can use either description. But for mixed states must use a density operator. So are there any questions about that? So perhaps the confusion was that I kept jumping between these two things, just like in the middle of the lecture, and I was treating them as the same thing, but perhaps you guys were thinking that something changed between this state and that state. Okay, so let's now carry on with the realistic postulates. So at the end of yesterday's lecture, we got to postulate two, which is that realistic dynamical transformations are prescribed by completely positive trace-preserving maps. And I gave you a mathematical definition of complete positivity, which we'll expand on today. And the reason they're trace preserving is because we want the probabilities to add to one. So we want the, if I input a density operator which has trace one, we want the output to have trace one as well. So today what I want to talk about is a explicit representation of these maps in terms of what's known as the Krauss decomposition. Okay, so I'm going to motivate this decomposition with an example. This won't give us the most general description, but then later on we'll get to a more general description once we start talking about composite systems. Okay, but so imagine that I have preparation rho, and I want to subject that that preparation to a transformation uj. So a unitary transformation with probability pj. So the effective description of this transformation would then be that I take my density operator rho, I apply the unitary uj to both sides, and then I take a sum, a weighted average over those. And so this is going to be our effective map on the state. And so we can represent this more abstractly as a sum over these operators aj acting on rho, where aj is given by the square root of the probability times the unitary operation. And so at this point, it seems a little bit trivial, but we'll see later that this decomposition can also represent more complicated transformations. And so for finite dimensional systems, for a discrete systems, there's always a decomposition of a CTP map in terms of this Krauss decomposition, although not always do the operators take that particular form. Okay, so what are some constraints on these operators? Well, oh, okay. And sorry, these operators are known as Krauss operators. Okay, so this map is non-unitary, so it's not going to preserve the purity. But like I said before, it always needs to preserve the normalization of the input state. So it needs to satisfy the following condition. So it ensures that it preserves the trace. And if the density operator has trace one to begin with, it's going to have trace one at the end. OK, so I have a question now for you guys. So given this explicit form of the Krauss operator, and let's say given some state, OK, let me draw it here so it's a bit clearer. So say this is a 2D projection of the Bloch sphere, and say I have some kind of mixed state somewhere in here. So given this form of the Krauss operators, can this map increase the purity of this state? And by purity, I mean you can think of it, well, you can map purity to the length of this vector in this space. You're shaking your head. So you're saying no, you can't?
I am saying no, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels to me like quantum operations have to increase entropy, and increasing entropy because purity is also an entanglement measure. It should also increase purity, but I don't know why. Like.
Yeah. Well, I think your intuition is right that this type of map cannot. But in general, it can, and we'll see that later. So I think your reasoning maybe is not leading to the right intuition, but I think your gut feeling here is correct, that at least for these operations, it cannot. And so maybe let me give you just an intuitive geometric picture of why not. So what we're doing here is that we're taking a probabilistic mixture of unitary transformations of this state. So all possible transformations will just be rotations on this Bloch sphere of this state. So all possible operators corresponding to this are going to lie somewhere on this circle or sphere in 3D space. And then recall that I told you that the way that we add you know, if I have two pure states on a Bloch sphere and then I have some kind of probabilistic mixture of these, the way that you add it is to, you know, draw a line here, and then depending on the weighting, your state would lie somewhere along here. So if all of my possible density operators have to lie somewhere in the circle, and then I'm taking a probabilistic mixture of these, any probabilistic mixture of states will lie somewhere inside this circle. And so maybe I have something like this, maybe it could be like a probabilistic mixture of three terms. So it'll be some weird average lying somewhere here. But at least geometrically, you should be able to see that there's no way to add things on the outside of the circle and get something, or sorry, add things on the surface of this and get something outside. So anytime you have a probabilistic mixture, it's going to necessarily shrink the length of your vector and reduce the purity. But we'll see later, once you add entanglement, in fact, you can have maps that increase the purity.
And well, I guess like restriction maps, well, but like if I take up like a pure vector, I restrict something.
So can I give you a physical example?
Yeah.
So imagine I have a two-level atom and so I have my ground and my excited state, and I prepare it into a mixed state that is a mixture of ground and excited. So this is a maximally mixed state because it'll lie on the inside of the sphere. But now I couple this to another system, which is, let's say, the electromagnetic field. And so now this thing is going to interact and it's going to decay to the ground state, probabilistically emitting a photon. And so afterwards, the state is going to be given by the ground state. So that interaction takes me from something that's a mixed state, and then because it's coupled to another system, it can take me to a pure state. So spontaneous emission.
Time evoluting,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Then restricting,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gives you
yeah, yeah.
Entropy that has entropy log 2 and the other has entropy 0. Nice.
Yeah, so these maps can be described by Krauss operators, we'll see later in the lecture, but they don't take this form.
Oh.
They're more general, and we have to derive them in a different way. Yes. Yeah.
Any measurement map is purifying.
Any measurement map is purifying? No, so we'll see if we can get to it later today. There are measurements that don't necessarily purify things as well. So they're things that are associated with maybe having lack of information about which measurement you actually made, for example. So not every, I think all projective measurements are going to, sorry, what was the statement? That it increases?
Any first, but then
yeah.
You just said that some classes of measurements.
Yeah, some classes of measurements purify it. Yeah, so we'll find that there are also some other measurements that do not, but I think all projective measurements will purify your state. But I would need to, that seems correct, but I would need to like check that, yeah.
What do we mean by purify?
Oh, okay, so I don't mean pure, so later we will talk about purifications as well, which is a mathematical statement about taking a density operator and writing it as a pure state on a larger dimensional Hilbert space. That's not what I meant here. Here I just meant physically applying a map that increases the purity. But those two things are different, and sometimes we use the same word for that. Okay, so good. So these maps, they cannot increase the purity. And so this is a special class of maps called unital maps. And so this is something, I will ask about this on the quiz. So the unital maps are the ones that do not increase purity. And they satisfy this extra condition, which looks very similar to that condition, or to this condition. But the dagger is on the other side. So let's see. All maps satisfy this. Oops, all physical worthwhile unital maps satisfy this. Okay.
Only the unital maps has that.
Oh, no, so all maps have a Krauss decomposition. All maps. But A only takes this form for unital maps. So later when we talk about these maps that increase purity, we'll see that they actually don't, they're not something that's proportional to the unitary. Okay, so now I wanted to give you a few examples of some, where are they? Of some maps that are used quite frequently in quantum information. And so these are known as quantum channels. So when I say channel, what I mean is some kind of way for a person to communicate information from A to B. So imagine some particle maybe traveling, a photon or something, or I don't know why you would use an, well, I guess we use electrons to communicate in classical physics, but some kind of particle traveling from me to maybe Alicia over there. And as it's traveling, it's experiencing it's experiencing some kind of interaction with the system, and then it is affected by the noise. Yep. So people obviously want to be able to characterize these transformations. And the most basic models are these three type of channels that I'm going to describe. So they're known as the bit flip channel, the phase flip channel, and the depolarizing channel. Okay, so number one, bit flip channel. Can anyone guess what the bit flip channel does?
It's a series of one.
Yeah.
Go into horizontal.
Sorry?
Go lower into horizontal and vertical.
Yeah. So bits, zeros and ones, flipping them would take. Yep. So. But if it was just doing that, it would just be a unitary transformation that would be a rotation along here. So we want it to be a little bit more general. So a bit flip channel induces a bit flip with some probability and does nothing with the rest of the time. So how do I want to say this? Okay, flips bit with prob P otherwise does nothing. And the way that we characterize this is to just, sorry, the way that we describe the map is to just give the Krauss operators for that map. And so it's described by two Krauss operators, which we call A0. And A1, where sigma 0 is just the identity and sigma x is the Pauli operator. So you can see, well, you can probably show for yourself that a Pauli operator is equivalent to a rotation about the x-axis by pi.
Do you make a similar flip on a different axis
mm-hmm.
by changing your polymatrix?
Exactly, yeah. So that's the next channel, which is called the phase flip channel. So what that does is it does the same thing, but about the z-axis. So And so you might be able to convince yourself that what that would do is take the state 0 plus 1 to the state 0 minus 1. And the same thing for like plus I to minus I. So it's flipping the phase term in the superposition. Yep. So let's write that down to phase flip. And you can have a channel that's the combination of both, and we don't give it a new name. It's just the phase bit flip channel, where you can apply one and then the other. But I won't bother writing that one down. I'll give you a third channel, which is known as the depolarizing channel. And so what this channel does is, with probability p, it replaces the state with the completely mixed state. And with probability 1 minus p, it doesn't do anything. And so to describe this, you need four Krauss operators. So the first operator corresponds to doing nothing, and then these other three Krauss operators are the thing that gives you, p rho. Okay. Yeah. These are the three Krauss operators are the thing that replaces rho with the identity, the maximally mixed state. So now, yes.
What is the difference between the operators A0 and E0? They are the same operators?
A0 are the same in that case, yeah. But A1 is different, because one is a sigma x and one is a sigma z.
I think they're both sigma c.
Sorry, at the top. Yeah. So the top one is an x. Does it look like a z?
For me.
Oh, man. Okay. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so now what?
Only when combining both of them does it make sense to differentiate them, right? Because, like, as written, like, the difference between Z and X is doing this, right?
Yes, when you think abstractly. But let's say you're someone that deals with a physical system that has a natural preferred basis, like the two-level atom, then they're physically very different things.
Yeah.
And so then you would have different timescales for the different processes, and it's useful to differentiate between them. But it's true, if we're just doing math, then they are kind of the same thing.
What do you mean by natural
basis? Oh, who said that? Oh, sorry.
What do you mean by natural preferred basis?
Like on an optical table, it's...
But a two-level atom, like the ground and excited states are the like energy eigenstates. and then creating superpositions of these. They're kind of special states that are a little bit different. Even though on the block sphere, they all kind of seem the same. Physically, the way that the transitions between the ground and excited states interact with the rest of the world is different to the way the superposition states interact with the rest of the world. Also, like with photons, kind of the right and left circularly polarized light behaves differently from the linear polarizations. So there, it actually, like the way the optical elements work, they act differently on linear polarizations than they act on the circularly polarized lights. And I guess you can think of other examples where there's like a preferred basis for the system, like maybe with probably like with spin, it doesn't much matter. Like I think spins are like any of the spins like are interchangeable. Yeah. Does that kind of answer the question though? Yeah. Okay. But it's not a precise statement. It's just kind of like a physically motivated statement. Okay. So I've given you these maps. What I'd like to now is just show you a quick Mathematica demo of what they do to the states on the block sphere. And actually, I wanted to show you a demo earlier about how the rotations work, but I ran out of time. But I linked to that Mathematica file on the wiki if you'd like to look at it. Okay, so the first one is the bit flip channel. So here is, you guys can have this file as well to play with later. So just to show you what these things mean, these theta and phis, they define the initial state that I want to apply the map to. So I don't know what's a good one. Okay, maybe let's start with a simple. Okay, let's start with that one. So that's the input state. And then to look at the output state, I'm going to change P, which is the thing that parameterizes how strongly the map acts on the state. So applying P, does anyone want to guess?
I'm sorry, I don't know which map.
Okay, this is the bit flip. So it's this top one. So let's say like I pick some P, like, I don't know, a half or something. Some non-zero, non-one P. Yeah, it'll do something to it in the z-axis. Yeah, and just make it shorter, I guess. So okay, I'm gonna increase P. And you can see, it's just taking the state to the maximally mixed state. Okay, so if I now.
The maximum is 1/2, right? And that'd be.
The maximum on here must be 1/2, yeah. Let's check what it is. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so I could also start with an initial state maybe here. And what's that going to do?
The same thing.
Vertically? Yeah. So are we going to end up with a maximally mixed state now?
No.
Exactly. Good. So it's just going to project everything onto the plane, the horizontal plane. Okay, so we can do the same thing for the phase flip channel. So let's again start with maybe this state. What's it going to do now?
Yeah.
What?
It's invariant.
Yeah, invariant. Cool. So apply PO, nothing's happening. So that seems like a nice basis to use for communication if you know that your channel is characterized by this particular noise. But let's start with a different state now, maybe something like that. What will that do? Go to the Z axis. Yep, cool. But I don't think it always takes it to the Z axis. So what if it's like that?
No, then it moves on a line that's parallel to the X axis.
Oh.
No.
No, why is it doing that?
That's weird.
That does seem weird. Yeah, I always find that weird. No, but it's definitely fine.
Cool.
Does that one do it? Does it always project into
it? You move 5 in the top one.
Yeah, that's always going to project onto the x-axis. Okay, cool. Yeah, I forgot that it does that. Okay, now let's increase. Yeah, okay. So it seems like it's always projecting onto the x-axis for the bit flip, and it's always projecting onto the z-axis for the phase flip. Which I think is actually true. Now that I like recall the, so I have a question on this on the quiz, where I have pictures of like the entire sphere and then like how the entire sphere compresses under the channel, and you're supposed to like guess which one's which. So I think they do go to a cigar shape, so that's consistent with it projecting onto the actual axis. Okay, and then the last one is the depolarizing channel, which acts a little bit differently. Who wants to guess? We can start with this state. It just gets shorter. Yeah, it's gonna take every state to the maximally mixed state. Oh, that's kind of weird. My P should probably be have a different final. Should that be a quarter, maybe? Okay, whatever. Anyway, that should be where it ends. I think I have my P to, what does it say? Yeah, whatever. We can check it. But anyway, that's where it's supposed to end. And let's try a different state, maybe. Something like that. Okay, let's add the channel. Yeah, it just gets shorter and goes, supposed to stop here at the identity. Okay, any questions? Oh, good.
So why we construct the tolerance channel this way?
Why?
Why we construct this way?
As opposed to which way?
Sorry, I just don't know. Can you prove it that it will goes to the maximum mixed state? It's probably P.
Yeah, I think I picked the wrong range for P. So you would need to find out. You would need to find out what the right P is that gives you the correct behavior. So there is some P for which it does what this does. How you would prove it, I don't know. But in the, okay, so if P equals zero, then clearly it does nothing.
Yeah.
For which P is it going to?
Goes to one.
To go to, so if P, because I guess you want this to go to zero. So then P has to be 4/3. Yeah. And then if it's 4/3 here, then you have 1 on root 3, 1 on root 3, 1 on root 3. And so what will that do? That'll be like,
P can be 4/3.
Yeah, so, okay, fine. Okay. Yeah, you're right. So P should go from zero to, the probability should go from zero to one, and it's going to be some function of P that goes from zero to 4/3. But I just didn't write down what that function is. Yeah. But we can, maybe that can be a tutorial question as well. Okay, let's move on. Okay, so far I motivated the realistic preparation postulate in terms of doing probabilistic preparations of pure states, and I motivated the realistic transformation postulate in terms of probabilistic applications of unitary transformations. So now for the measurement postulate, the realistic one, I will motivate that as probabilistic application of projective measurements. So we'll see how the formalism looks for these states. But then, as with all of the things, once we introduce composite systems and entanglement, we'll see that those descriptions fit into this framework, but are just more general than the examples I'm giving you right now. So a realistic measurement procedure. Is represented by a POVM, which is this set of operators. The index M refers to measurement outcomes. May occur in the experiment. And the probability of finding outcome M given preparation rho. Is the trace of the POVM element and the operator rho. Now, POVM stands for positive operator valued measure. In the context of all of this finite dimensional, discrete stuff that we're doing here, the name is just not very descriptive of what's going on at all. You can think of it as just like a noun that came from historical reasons. So with like CPTP, that's important. So all of those things mean something and they tell you about the properties of the map here. Like, just don't worry about if that means something to you, then like that's good. But if it doesn't, you just don't need to know what that means. So, and in fact, like most people can in quantum information can get away with not knowing what that means. So let's not worry about it. Okay, so they're just a set of elements and they satisfy some properties. So a discrete positive, okay, let's write it like this, POVM, and then just in brackets put positive operator valued measure is any set of operators that satisfy the following conditions. So it's these conditions that are going to be important for you to remember. So the sum of the operators adds to the identity. And they're also non-negative for all m. Okay, so let me just try and, okay, so some terminology. This set is what, okay, this entire set is what we call the POVM, and the elements inside are POVM elements. And sometimes, sometimes rather than describing this as measurements described by POVMs, people use the terminology generalized measurements as opposed to projective measurements. So those things are equivalent in this context. Okay, so let's consider an example. Yep.
The operator is greater than or equal to zero.
That it has no negative eigenvalues.
So then should be m is greater than or equal to zero? What do you mean? What's, is E of m the operator itself or
E
of the eigenvalues?
Yeah, okay, that's probably bad notation.
Yeah, EM should be the operator as well.
EM is the operator, yeah. But...
So is it a positive semi-definite? Is it equivalent to
the sign of greater?
I think it means that it's positive semi-definite, but I don't want to say... Let me confirm that again as well. What are you saying? What are you saying it is, Ivan?
That it can be written as B dagger B. It's exactly the same as the spectra being positive. Like
okay.
What you said at the beginning, yeah, that the spectrum of the operator is positive.
Okay, that's right.
It has B dagger B.
Sorry?
You mean that it has decomposition? You mean that it has a decomposition? two equivalent statements, which is that the spectrum is positive, and an equivalent statement is also that it can be written as B dagger B for some operator. So like in complex numbers, a complex number is positive if it can be written as Z, as the norm of another complex number.
Okay.
So I'm curious, is it equivalent that a spectrum is positive and to say is that the operator is positive semi-definite? Because I think...
No, but positive semi-definite is for bilinear forms.
Yeah.
Every operator induces a bilinear form,
yeah,
through the inner product,
yeah,
and I think that positive semi-definiteness of the bilinear form is the same as
but
positive.
I think, do we need the Hermitian to say that the spectrum is positive?
Yeah, that's implied. When you say that something is, if you have a real spectrum, then your operator is as a consequence Hermitian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Having real spectrum is the same as being Hermitian.
Okay. There are so many implicit.
So many what?
Implicit conditions like that it is Hermitian. I think it should be added to the definition. Oh, no.
Yeah.
You can say that it's spectrum positive.
Okay, we can continue this discussion in the tutorial. But everyone's mostly happy now. Thanks, Ivan, for the technical details. That's awesome.
I am sorry for being up with him.
No, I think it's fantastic. No, I think it's, I really appreciate it. I think it's great.
Thank you.
Okay, so yeah, let's look at an example. So again, we're going to consider a qubit, and in this situation, we're going to make a measurement in one of two possible bases. And we're going to pick this basis with some probability. So with probability 1/4, I will measure in the sigma z basis. And with probability 3/4, I'll measure in the sigma x basis. So you could just describe the procedure like this. But an alternative way to describe it is to give the effective POVM elements for this procedure. And so these are going to be E0 is 1/4 out of product of 0, 0. Similarly for E1. So are these projectors? Sure. So they look like projectors, but they're not because they have this coefficient out the front. So if you were to square E0, you would get 1/16 0, 0. And so it doesn't satisfy the property that projectors satisfy, that when you square them, you get the same thing. OK, do they satisfy this condition? Hopefully. Actually, as I was writing, I kind of panicked that they didn't, but I think they do. Because this thing, if you add these two together, you have 1/4 the identity, and when you add these two together, you have 3/4 the identity. So then 1/4 identity plus 3/4 of identity gives you identity. So that's good. Okay, so what's the probability of getting outcome 0? Oh, okay. So given preparation, rho equals 0, 0, Then, okay, given preparation 0, 0, what's the probability of getting outcome plus? Well, we can calculate that using the Born rule or the generalized Born rule. So we have probability plus is given by the trace of the POVM element and the initial state. And so what will we get? Well, this 3/4 can go out the front. And then we can use the cyclic property of the trace to move this over to there. And we find that we're just going to have something like this. And then the overlap of these two of this Brian Laquette is going to be 1 on root 2, and this one will be 1 on root 2. So we have 3/4 times 1/2, which is 3 on 8. Some people really don't like my trick of splitting up the bras and kets and moving the kets over to there. So if you don't like that, you can just calculate the trace explicitly and you'll get the same thing. But I haven't found a situation where that fails, and probably there is a proof to say why it's okay to do that. I just never found one. Okay, so that's how we calculate the probability. How are we going for time? Okay. So that's one example. I want to give you a slightly different example, which at first seems similar, but it's a bit different. Okay, so that was describing a situation where I just do one of two possible basis measurements with some probability. Now I want to describe what I'm calling a noisy measurement. So that one's not noisy because you always know what the outcome is. It's a four outcome measurement, and you'll either get outcome 0, 1, plus or minus. But now imagine a situation where I would like to measure in the 0, 1 basis, but there's something that's kind of causing that basis to fluctuate. So maybe I'm doing a measurement in a lab, but there's some train rushing past and it's shaking things and it's causing my apparatus to kind of fluctuate a little bit. So we want to find some way of describing that particular situation. So how I want to motivate this, or how I want to describe this. So imagine that I want to measure in the 0, 1 basis, but this train's going past, it's fluctuating, causing it to fluctuate. So what I end up doing is measuring in a slightly perturbed basis that I'll call 0 plus, 1 plus. Or it might fluctuate in the other direction, and I'll call this 0 minus and 1 minus. In practice, you would want to kind of take into account all possible fluctuations here, but just for simplicity, I'm going to consider just these two possible deviations from 0. And so it might seem similar because I, again, have two bases that I'm choosing from, but I no longer have four outcomes. In this case, I only have two outcomes, because I think that I'm just making a 0, 1 basis measurement. So my device is always going to just say 0 or 1, but I'm not going to know whether 0 corresponds to this or this. So in that case, I have a POVM described by two elements. So the one corresponding to 0 will look like this, and the one corresponding to 1 will look like this.
Is there a range of the fluctuation? Like, how do you define, like, how big is the...
Well, oh, okay, the way that it would come into here would be how you define the 0 and 1 states. So did I, maybe I didn't write them down. But you'll be able to write down that 0 plus is going to be some probability 0 and then... It'll be some superposition state, and the amount of fluctuation from here is going to be parametrized by this p here. And then the opposite state, I guess it would have like a minus sign because it'll be a deviation in the other direction. And so depending on what you pick as these basis elements, it's going to give you different outcomes. So the description of this measurement will be different. So, I mean, at the moment, we're just saying it's some arbitrary p. In practice, you might be able to characterize, like, what happens to your measurement given, you know, when a train goes past or something like that. Usually, I think what people would do in practice is they would have some model like this without putting in what the p is, and then they would apply that to their simulations of the experiment, and then they would look at the data from the experiment and then tweak it to find the p that matches the experiment.
But you only can do it for the p.
Pardon me?
You have to be a p.
Right. So So the state that here, it's actually a state that corresponds to a projector. So what I'm saying is that my device, it always makes a projective measurement onto this basis. I just don't know what the basis is. So you could have a measurement that does something different, but I'm saying that this particular experiment that I'm describing is a device that always makes a projective measurement. I just don't know the basis which it made the projective measurement in. So when I have a projective measurement, it's always going to be written in some form. My projector will always look like this, and I can always then describe my projector as a pure state like that. But what I'm writing down here is not the state of the system, it's the actual, like, I'm describing the measurement with that ket. So that p defines the measurement basis of the projective measurement. But then because I don't know what the which basis it is, my two elements, my POVM elements have to be described by some average over those outcomes. Yeah.
Why do you have two outcomes? Why aren't you counting 0 and 1?
Well, I could. So it just depends how I want to model this. Like, I could say, in practice, what I would imagine is that there would be some continuous distribution of deviations from this little thing, and then I would discretize that and like weight it appropriately. Maybe I'll discretize it into 100 things. Maybe there's even some clever way of doing it continuously. For this particular example, I just wanted to do the most simple thing. And so I said my options are that only this thing or that thing happens. It might, maybe a better model would have been something like this, plus maybe half like that. Like that's another model, which is probably more accurate. Most of the time nothing happens, but sometimes it deviates. So that's a good model as well. But just for the particular example, I wanted to pick the simplest thing possible. Okay, so kind of let's think about what we would expect to happen here. So given preparation, rho equals 1, 1. So this is a pure state. Assume that everything was perfect. And rather than doing this measurement, I was just doing a projective measurement onto the 0 and 1 basis. Then given preparation 1, the probability of getting an outcome 0 would be 0. I would just never get the outcome 0. If I make a projective measurement in sigma z, I'll always get the outcome 1. But now that we have a little bit of noise, let's see what happens. Let's see what the probability of getting outcome 0 is. So again, we're going to just apply the Born rule. We have the POVM element and the initial state. And then you can go through and do the calculation. So it would look something like this, where this number, this is going to be a number, but it'll depend on the actual form of this, of the state. And I erased it, but you know, it could have looked something like this. And so if p is less than 1, there's going to be some overlap between this state 1 and this initial state, and same for here. So the exact number that we get is going to depend on how far this deviation from the z-axis is, but the key point is that it's not 0, let's say, for p less than 1. And actually, if p was 1, then this state would be 0, and you would find that this then would give you back the projected 0, 0, and 1, 1. So that would describe the perfect measurement, but for p less than 1, we have this imperfect measurement, and now given preparation 1, the probability of getting outcome 0 is non-zero. Okay, so that's two different examples of how you might use POVMs to compute measurements that are more general than the projective measurements. Later I will, I guess by now it'll have to be on Monday, I'll talk about even more general POVMs and generalized measurements that let you do some cool things that you wouldn't be able to do. But now I'd like to talk a little bit about the state update rule for these situations. So we haven't yet discussed that. We've just looked at the Born rule. So Okay, so it turns out that this POVM does not contain enough information to specify the state update rule. It's enough to give you the statistics of the experiment, but it's not going to tell you what state you have at the end if you were going to then put it into another experiment and try and calculate statistics after that. So let's write this down. POVM does not contain enough info for this. And so we need to know how the POVM was actually created. Or maybe implemented is a better word. Okay, and so the information that tells you how it was implemented is given by how we decompose the POVM elements into some other operators known as the measurement operators. And so the decomposition is that EM looks like this. So let's see if we can figure out. One way that this could be satisfied here is if M, let's say, M0, okay, let's call little m0 and I plus. So then that would be the first term, and then this would be the second term in that sum. And then you would have to write down a particular form of m dagger that squared to give you something like this. So I'm not going to go through the a particular example for this case, but I will give you a particular example for that other case, which is simpler because it only has one term in the POVM. OK, so let's call it I didn't write down example one for that, but that was example one. So example one continued. Oh, but I didn't give you the state update rule. Sorry. Okay, so given that decomposition, you would then have the state M, given outcome M, it will be given as the sum over I, M acting on rho, M dagger, over the probability of getting outcome M. So some notes, I are not in general projectors. And if we have this condition, So if that is met and then the sum over that, over I has only one term, then we have the ideal measurement postulate. So I will make this clear with an example just in a second. Okay, so what do we do in that example? We had those four POVM elements, and then we calculated the probability of getting the outcome plus. So now the question is, what is the state given outcome plus? Okay, so to answer that question, we have to know how it's decomposed. So for example, if we implemented the measurement like this, so where our m plus was given by that operator, we can check that, of course, I mean, this is kind of a trivial case, but you can check that if you have this, you're going to get the POVM the POVM up there. So if we had this implementation, then we just calculate the state update rule as specified up there. And we get okay, so that's kind of what you would expect from something, from something that was that corresponds to the physics of what I described there. So what I was describing is I'm making a projective measurement either in one basis or another basis, and so it kind of makes sense. Well, if I make the measurement in this basis and I get outcome plus, then yeah, I'm just going to get the state update rule plus plus. Like nothing surprising here. But it's possible that those POVMs correspond to a different physical situation. So let's now, well, those POVM elements. So let's now imagine that the scenario is almost what I just described. But rather than making a projective measurement, I'm making a measurement of the photon polarization, the way that I described in those optics experiments. So I create something, I have my photon gun. And then I have my wave plates, my polarizing beam splitter. And then I like have these photo detectors. So it might seem like this would correspond to some kind of projective measurement. And the basis in which I'm making the measurement would depend on the settings of the wave plates. But in fact, it's not projective because, as we said earlier, when you detect a photon, you're destroying it. The measurement device absorbs the photon and then it's gone. So I can't now make another measurement on that in the same basis because it's just gone. Like, so the projective, the description of projective measurements that we had before does not apply here. So we need to kind of expand our description in order to describe this scenario. So the correct description is to increase the size of the Hilbert space. So far, we've just been talking about photons that have a particular polarization. But we also need to account for the case of no photons. So we need to include in our Hilbert space maybe the vacuum state. So we don't just have horizontal or vertical, but we also can have a state that I can call the vacuum state. So, well, let's call this where 0 and 1 are the same as the horizontal and vertical. And then this is the vacuum state. So it's just something that doesn't even have any photons. And so in that case, I would say that the thing that corresponds to M plus is going to be square root of 3 on 4 vacuum state and then a plus polarized state. So now that's something different. We haven't seen something like that before, at least not in this course. And so can we check, does this, clearly this thing is not a projector. So it doesn't satisfy that. Can we check that it gives the right POVM? Well, yeah. So the inner product of, we're going to assume the vacuum state is normalized state. So inner product of vacuum gives you 1. And so you're just left with this plus and the plus here, which gives you the right POVM. And now let's do the state update rule. So the state given outcome plus will be M acting on the zero state, which was the input state, and then M dagger divided by the probability, which we calculated to be 3/8. And I'm not going to go through all of the steps, but you can check for yourself that when you go through it, so you'll have an overlap between this bra and this ket, which will give you 1 on root 2. You'll have the same here, 1 on root 2. And then you'll just be left with these outer product terms. So in the end, everything cancels nicely. And we get the vacuum state at the end. So that's a better description of the photon measurement because it gives us the statistics that we would expect with doing projective measurements, but it describes the state update, what happens to the state of the particle more accurately because after the measurement, there's no photon.
When you say you found the right POVM, what do you mean by that? What's the right POVM?
So what I mean is initially in the example, I gave you a set of POVMs that was describing a situation where you were oh, sorry, I gave you a POVM that was describing the situation of measuring in this basis with probability a quarter and in this basis with probability three quarters. So that was some scenario. And then I was suggesting that this optical implementation could give me that scenario as long as I change like the settings on these wave plates to be one setting with a probability a quarter and one setting with probability three quarters. So I can find a description that gives me those POVMs, but in order to get the state update rule correctly, I have to have a particular decomposition of those POVMs.
You could have written m plus equals three quarters, zero and plus. That would have given the same thing, right? So
yeah, it would have given me the right POVM, but it wouldn't have given me the right state update rule. Yeah, so I mean, but this is the point, that there are many different decompositions that give you the right POVM. So there's many ways of implementing an experiment that gives you the same statistics. The thing that differs about all of these decompositions is what happens to the state after you've done the experiment.
But how do you select,
the right one? Oh, it's an art. You have to think about what's happening physically. You have to talk to some experimentalists, and they're like, oh, this is the experiment that I'm doing. And then you're like, oh, what's the right way to describe this experiment? And you kind of use your experience and intuition with how experiments work to devise a model. And so then you would come up with this model and say, I think this is a good model for your experiment. And then you make predictions, and then the experimentalists do their experiments and you compare them. And then you're like, well, this is a pretty good model because it matches the experimental outcomes. So, I mean, in this case, it's a bit, you can't really do much with it because if it's the vacuum state, it's gone. But one way that you would usually check whether your state update rule was, whether your measurement operator gave you the right state update rule is to then take the output of that experiment and then put it into another experiment and check if that gives you the right statistics. Because you can kind of think about this whole measurement setup as another form of state preparation that then can be put into a different experiment, and then you check the Born rule for that particular experiment.
So basically going in reverse, basically we do know the final state that's about that will come, or we know the final state that will be, and we're kind of finding the measurement corresponding to it. That's right.
So you have some general idea of how a particular measurement device works. So you just want to write down the math that would describe it. So yeah, in this case, I know that photon counters eat my photons and they leave a vacuum state. So yeah, that's why I would write it down. Hopefully when you do more and more and more complicated experiments, that you then can't just think about it and say, I expect this will be the outcome, then you would use all of these primitive elements that you've developed to put them all together and describe a much more complicated experiment that you need to actually model rather than just intuit, if that makes sense. All right, so I'll see you guys in the tutorial. And yeah, we're running a bit behind in terms of material, but I think we'll still get through everything before the end. So all of the stuff about entanglement that I promised you today, we'll have to wait until Monday. But see you this afternoon.